I think folks don't always know how important what we call it as field work, which is like door knocking and phone banking, is to a campaign, whether that it's a candidate campaign or an issue campaign. There's still, despite what people think, there's something still really powerful about that one-to-one conversation. Folks are able to receive like a pamphlet. They see a candidate knock on their door. That's actually a really, really powerful tool, despite kind of all the technology that we have that folks might think otherwise.
This is the Bris Poinsett Show. This is the Bris Poinsett Show. For the world's most dangerous infomercial, I'm your host, Bris Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio of the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bris Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode features my conversation with Danny Cage and Joy Elise Davis, No Cops in Schools, No Police Money in Politics, where we tackle the campaigns to, one, remove SROs, a.k.a. student resource officers, a.k.a. armed cops, from public schools, from schools in general, and that campaign to limit the influence of the police lobby in electoral politics. This was part of the Vanport Mosaic's Black Panther Legacy Celebration, and it's a very, very insightful conversation about what's actually happening on the ground and how these different institutions are engaging with the people, or in many cases, not engaging with the people on these issues of public safety that directly and often negatively affect us. Check it out. Help support this channel and get early access to videos plus exclusive content and patrons-only live discussions by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bris Poinsett.
Together for No Cops in Schools. This event, as you all know, was postponed due to the snowstorm. And it was part of a multi-day event, the Vanport Mosaic hosting, to look at the legacy of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party and the party in general, but also to see what efforts and initiatives are being engaged with today so that people can be more aware of them and participate. And specifically this year, Mr. Ford and I were thinking that we would look at points 7, 8, and 9 of the party's 10-point platform. And for those who might not be directly familiar with those, 7 reads: we want an immediate end to police brutality and the murder of Black people. 8, we want freedom for all Black men held in federal, state, county, city, prisons, and jails. And 9, we want all Black people, when brought to trial, to be tried in a court by a jury over their peer group or people from their Black communities, as defined by the Constitution of the United States. And we thought that points 7, 8, and 9 from 1966 were still super relevant today. And so now we have an event led by Bris Poinsett, No Cops in Schools, No Police Money in Politics. And Bris, I'm so glad that you are here, and I will introduce you and then we'll go from there. Bris is a writer and a friend whose work is primarily based in the Portland metro area. He was a former reporter for the Scanner News Group, and his writing has also appeared in The Oregonian and Street Roots, Oregon Humanities, and Eater PDX, as well as projects such as the Mercatus, if I pronounce that correctly, Collective, and the Urban League of Portland State of Black Oregon 2015. He hosts the YouTube series, The Blacktastic Adventures, the virtual exploration of Oregon's Black diaspora, and the Bruce Poinsett Show on 96.7 The Numbers FM, which is Portland's Black radio station. And Mr. Poinsett also works with Respond to Racism Lake Oswego, which is a grassroots anti-racism organization in his hometown of Lake Oswego, Oregon. So welcome, Bruce and friends.
Yes, thank you, Damaris, for that great intro. And thank you all for being with us here tonight. Our program, No Cops in Schools, No Police Money in Politics, conversation with Danny Cage and Joy Elise Davis on the campaigns to both remove SRO or keep SROs out of Portland public schools specifically and remove SROs from Oregon schools in general, and to combat the outsized influence of the police lobby in Oregon politics. Quick housekeeping notes as far as the format. We're going to have a general conversation with my guests coming up shortly, and then we'll be opening up the conversation to audience Q&A a little bit later. I'll let you all know when you can start throwing your questions in the chat as we get closer to that point. So before I introduce my guests, and let's have them kind of sit there and be stared at, and my apologies for that, but it's all good. I just want to set the table a little bit, kind of bring things into context, because as Damaris pointed out, the points 7 through 9 specifically of the, well, one, we stand on the shoulders of so many, including the Black Panthers, and specifically in this case, the Portland Black Panthers and Mr. Ford. And points 7 through 9 of the 10-point program specifically deal with the police system and our justice system, or injustice system, as many would look at it. And right now, that brings us into 2023, where the conversation around public safety, for being quite honest, is being led by fear and dictated and dominated by the police lobby. Go back to 2020 and these historic protests, which, among other things, put a national spotlight on brutality by Portland police. And you got a lot of statements, a lot of people saying they're listening to Black leaders, they want to work with the Black community, they want to get serious about justice. And while a lot of actions, unfortunately, didn't follow, one of the things that did come from that was the removal of SROs from Portland public schools, as well as some other districts who followed. In some cases, like I'd like to point out, like, for example, students at Gresham School District really dragged their school district to follow. But nonetheless, we had those moments. However, since that time, you've seen a very swift backlash in just politics and society. So look at there's maybe one vote to finally not increase the Portland police budget. And that narrative has been used, as many of you may have seen in this most recent midterm elections, to say that not just have police been defunded, but that is the reason why Portland is apparently on fire, is these quote unquote defund the police radicals are responsible for everyone's issues with public safety, even though the budget has since been increased and is continuing to increase. You know, some recent headlines, for example, from the Oregonian, March 2nd, 2023, Portland police buy 144 new cars, unveil new design and features. Or let's go to Coin News. February 1st, 2023, City Council approves PPB spending $1.5 million on new patrol plane. So yes, that is $1.5 million for a new plane for the police. And just this March 8th, OPB report finds Portland leaders tried to avoid competitive process for truth and reconciliation project. And specifically, city officials initially went with a new company with ties to the Portland Police Bureau. So you have, or actually, let me, one more thing while we're here, because I think just something that really stood out to me was the targeting by both Portland Police and specifically the Portland Police Association of former Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. And perhaps the biggest incident of that was tying her, you know, falsely tying her to a hit and run and proliferating that information, for which Officer Brian Hunziker was initially initially fired for that, but was, as many know, was very recently reinstated. So again, when we're talking about the power of the police lobby, you get these examples. So that brings us to the most, I think the thing that's been on a lot of people's minds, and, you know, I think especially gets to people's heartstrings when you talk about young people with shootings outside of Jeff, Cleveland, and Franklin, which have been used to seize upon this need to try and bring SROs, which are student resource officers, which are armed police officers, for those who don't know, back to Portland public schools. And again, when we talk about this conversation kind of being led by fear, what I think one thing that's happened in this is we're forgetting why they were, honestly, we're not seeing a lot of voices. You're seeing the police voice overrepresented, and you're kind of forgetting some of the reasons. We're not really talking about the reasons they were taken out in the first place. So just to remind you before I bring my guests in, there is a ACLU report in 2019 titled "Cops and No Counselors: How Lack of School Mental Health Staff is Harming Students." And I'm going to just throw that in the chat there for people if they'd like to look along. But some of the things that report found is that SROs have a tendency of physically harassing students of color, sexually harassing female students of color, bullying and harassing and intimidating students of color and students with disabilities, especially students who come from immigrant families. Also, inappropriately sharing and accessing student or sensitive student information. What it did find that SROs were not particularly effective at, however, in fact, completely ineffective at, was stopping gun-related incidents at schools, which has kind of been the big, again, in the midst of school shootings especially, has been a big call for why we need to put more officers back in schools. So with that said, I'm going to bring my guests into this conversation. We have Danny Cage, who is a current senior at Grant High School and is also running for the Multnomah Education Service District, Position 6. And Joy Elise Davis, who's the executive director of Imagine Black, a grassroots organization that helps the Black community imagine the alternatives it deserves and builds political participation and leadership to achieve those alternatives. So Danny, Joy Elise, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, there we go. So first place we'll start is, I know, again, Imagine Black was a big part of that initial push to get SROs out of, well, I shouldn't say initial, but that push to get SROs out of PPS in 2020. And if I'm doing my math right, I think, Danny, SROs would have been there your first year, if I'm correct? Or?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, with that context, when you started seeing this push to bring SROs back, I'm just curious, like, for both of you, what were your initial reactions?
I will say my initial reactions, kind of disappointing, only because I remember those who were a little bit older than me who were engaged in some of the work, who were at school board meetings and testifying and about the removal of SROs. And it feels like an insult in some ways to the work that we've been able to progress on removing of armed officers from our schools.
Yeah, and I will I would just add that, like mentioned before, so many folks advocated for this for years, for decades. I can't say that I am surprised in this moment that leadership on the city council is considering. And I was disappointed to hear that the school board, because most of those folks were still there in 2020 and they remember when they made that historic vote. But I'm not surprised. I think the narrative right now, like you mentioned earlier, Bruce, is that we've had somehow defunded the police and that, you know, the city is in mayhem and burning because of it. When in reality, I think you mentioned it before, is that our police budget is the biggest it's ever been for the city of Portland. And all the folks are kind of leveraging this moment of pain and grief and uncertainty. That happens, I think, when we're still in a pandemic and still dealing with so much crisis. We've been in a housing crisis for such a long time. There's so many things that like add to this moment, and it's actually quite disrespectful to contribute it solely to a very significant but also change or shift that happened in 2020 that we've seen the city of Portland and other folks roll back on pretty quickly.
Yeah, and Joylyce, in past conversations, you've talked about budgets being moral documents. Not to mention, both of you have really been very vocal about, you know, alternatives where we could be putting the money, whether it's the city of Portland or Portland Public Schools. So to that end, first off, what are the things in these various spaces, especially with these institutions, that, like, what actually makes you feel safe, whether it be in the schools, on the streets of Portland? And when it comes to these budgets specifically, what are some alternative areas where you think these institutions could be investing their money instead of into more police?
Yeah, I'll start. You know, I have been reflecting quite a bit around this concept of community care over the last few months. I found this article from Melissa Harris Perry back in the day that talked about, like, care is the reason why we have communities, why we form government, why we do the work that we've been trying or striving to do for so long. And when we look at the history of policing in this country, it wasn't built on community care. It was built on protecting white interests, white property. It was built to harm folks that look like me and many of the folks on this call. And it's I think just really unfortunate that we are so wrapped up in our fear that we're not taking a second to understand the world around us and how we got to this place. When I think about alternatives and what keeps me safe, I think about having basic needs. I think about access to food. I think about housing. I think about healthcare. I think about public policies that were designed to support vulnerable folks that are situated differently, that need support. I think a lot, if I'm quite honest, about my own like experience with policing and particularly thinking about like domestic violence. Like I grew up in a house that had quite a lot of domestic violence. My father is a retired cop. And you can imagine what happens when a police officer comes to the door after a domestic violence dispute and they find out that one of their own is there, that the energy changes, the posture changes, they check to see if you're alive, and then they kind of move on. And I keep thinking about how powerful would it have been if a counselor, a social worker, someone who actually cared about the community or cared about my family showed up and asked us how we were doing, gave us options, actually went through a different process that wasn't built on violence and wasn't kind of built on kind of this fraternal or this brotherhood that we often hear about when it comes to policing. I think about my needs being met. I think about if I'm getting pulled over, it's not because I didn't pay, you know, a ticket or I didn't have my, you know, didn't put my turn signal on. I think about someone who's actually asking me if I need support, changing my tire, changing my tags, my lights when I need it, and not coming with force and violence and trying to trick me into anything. I think it's really just a, she said, it's a moral thing. And I think it's really outrageous that the police budget has grown the way that it has. And I think if we were really honest with ourselves, we can redesign the system. And I think it's about time we do it. I'm going to stop ranting, so I'll pass it on.
I'm so glad that you talked about CARE. It's actually one of my favorite books, The CARE Manifesto. Not sponsored, no, just playing. But I think a lot about resources in the context of not just students in our schools, but also in the context of what our communities are able to access. The school that I currently go to as of now has over 2,000 students in a school building, and there are less than 7 counselors. So you can imagine that needs are not getting met, especially during test weeks. Counselors are sometimes unavailable for up to 2 weeks, which is, I think, a real deficit to our society to not even have counselors available. Well, meanwhile, we're having a conversation about cops. So I think a lot about resources, not just for our students, but as well as our community members to be able to have.
Yeah, and it's interesting you said that statistic of, you say 7 counselors?
Yes.
Wow. And I imagine, again, just, you know, you have students coming from a whole bunch of different experiences. So that probably doesn't even get into counselors being able to be, you know, specialists when it comes to like identity and different perspectives, I imagine. When we talk about public safety, one of the things with Imagine Black is trying to like create tools to actually, you know, actually affect as far as like the police union's outsized influence in politics. And one of those is the No Police Money Pledge. Joylyce, would you mind kind of talking about like what is the No Police Money Pledge? And, you know, how does Imagine Black use it to really hold elected officials and candidates accountable?
Yes, I would love to. So this is a project that we actually started dreaming up back in 2020. We were inspired by different organizations around the country that were finding different ways to hold police accountable and recognizing that there's so many different avenues and different spaces that need to happen. We need folks doing mutual aid. We need folks raising money to bail folks out. We need folks working with youth that are impacted. We need folks actually doing policy changes and getting involved in electoral justice to really make sure that we can hold folks accountable from a different lens. So we were thinking we're one of the few Black-led organizations in the state that can endorse candidates and that can get involved in elections work here in Oregon. And what we found in research is that we just need to get police union money out of politics in all levels of government and decision making. Unions are using their political campaign contributions to support certain candidates who align with their ideology. It's interesting. Prior to this last election, I'm thinking really seriously about like Washington County's district attorney race. The amount of money that police unions put into that race to make sure that someone who was friendly, quote unquote, to police was just outrageous, to the point where, you know, we were tracking and taking a look at police money from the last 10 years. And I just have not seen that much money flow to a single candidate from multiple unions in the same way. But what we're interested in doing is using different muscles to make sure that we can hold folks accountable. We're interested in shifting power and making sure that people actually have that power to elect folks and allow those elected officials to hold police accountable. It's much, you know, difficult to do that when, you know, I'm not saying they're in their pockets, but it's hard to tell someone who gives you a lot of money that you don't agree with them. It's also really I'm trying to think about comparing it to fossil fuels. I remember years ago, it was kind of unheard of. I'm not that old, but I'm thinking, I remember when I was younger, it was unheard of to have folks talk about not taking money from fossil fuel industry. And now it's actually quite difficult. Most folks say with pride that they don't take money from that industry. I've seen folks around the country do the same with NRA, are trying to push and normalize this concept that we don't have to take their money. And you can be objective. I think some folks believe that if you are not taking police money, if you take this pledge that you don't, you know, want to work with cops, it's actually quite the opposite. We want you actually to use your power to flex that muscle, to actually do what you were elected to do. And you can't do that when you are backed by police interests. So what we're hoping to do is to get money out of police to support candidates and persuade them and elected officials to refuse to take those donations. And if they have, to give them back. We want to get them out of decision-making so that we can hold them accountable. We want to ensure that candidates are able to do that work without influence and that they feel empowered to do what we elected them to do. I put a link to our website. I would love for folks to take a look at it. We're hoping that in this upcoming race, we can, whether it's school board all the way up to county, up to, you know, upcoming governor races, that we can get folks to actually take this pledge and take it seriously.
Yeah. And if a politician signs it and then they just go back to taking police money, how does Imagine Black hold them accountable from there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what we've been doing is tracking most police or just campaign contributions over a certain amount has to be tracked by the state. So there's a website where you can actually see how, you know, each candidate is being funded. Who's kind of putting the most money into, and, you know, again, your money and budgets, you know, are moral documents. I think donations are as well. And in terms of how you are aligned with a particular candidate. So we're tracking it. And I think what is really unique for us, again, because we are one of the few Black led orgs that can do elections work, we can actually call people out in a different way with a little bit of a unapologetic, bold nature, in a way that some traditional 501c3s want to, but they might be limited in their legal capacity. So we could actually do a lot of campaign work. We could do media. We can put pressure. And I think the ultimate pressure is actually we can get them out of office. We don't forget things like most people do, and we can remember. And when it's time to have them up for election again, we can, you know, get them out of there. We can actually support candidates that are more aligned, that represent our interests. So I think it's about being able to flex that power, being able to be really honest and let the public know what they did and how they backed up or backed out, so to speak, from their pledge, and ultimately vote them out of office.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm always struck. We talk about the influence of police union money in these conversations. Whenever I hear about, you know, whether it's a community visioning session or info gathering session or just general, you know, testimonies, be it at school board meetings, at city council, where it always seems, you know, over, whether it be, you know, Portland City Council most recently with myriad measures just targeting houseless people and the pushback, thankfully, from many in the community against that. But then even, you know, again, my hometown of Lake Oswego, where they did, you know, listening sessions with students on SROs, and any student who's talked about it said they're overwhelmingly negative, but somehow that gets up to administrators and the messages, they're either indifferent or they support SROs, again, because apparently there's no accountability to these other groups except for this police lobby and the pressure of the police lobby. So any tools to like fix that kind of like distortion, I think, are just one, just really exciting opportunities. But speaking of public office, I did want to bring Danny into this conversation as a student currently running for school board in the Multnomah Education Service District. And one, I'm just curious, because, you know, you made the announcement very recently, how much things like this SRO decision especially affected that. But then also, you just talk about the importance of having someone who's, you know, just kind of like literally the opposite of removed from being a student in such a position.
Yeah. One of the most interesting things I think about the education system is that our students are the primary stakeholders. And I mean that quite literally. There wouldn't be teachers, principals, administrators, school board members. Quite literally no one would be there without our students. And yet, you know, we talk about, you know, them wanting to push out SROs, like you mentioned before in Lake Oswego, in PPS, but they aren't really included in that decision-making process or their ideas are regarded. And so, you know, really making sure that we understand that students not only are stakeholders, but their decisions and their ideals and their wisdom and their motivation that they have to create a better education system makes them the perfect stakeholder in our system.
Yeah. And kind of to that point, can you just talk about like in your experience, especially around this SRO discussion, like what some of those, whether it be engaging at the school board meeting level, getting some of these other discussions, what does that look like for those who are, you know, aren't able to attend the meetings, aren't able to kind of like be behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think one of the most difficult things about, you know, those who have the ability to testify, those who have the ability to show up, historically don't look like me. and I think that, you know, you can see in the fact that school board meetings are predominantly dominated by people who give public testimony in, you know, the West Side, or people who give public testimony in certain areas of Portland. And so I really think it matters on who is speaking and who is feeling safe, because we talk a lot about, you know, in this conversation about people don't feel safe, but it's not regarding everyone. It's regarding those who have historically felt comfortable by policing, because policing was made for and by a certain community. It was not made to uphold and protect all people in our society.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of, again, just talking about Lake Oswego School District, because with Respond to Racism, we had a student panel on SROs back, I want to say August. And one of the responses we got from Lake Oswego School District, so shout out to Superintendent Jen Sheely, shout out to John Park, said, well, we took a survey of students and, you know, they don't seem to be bothered, but it's like, this town is literally nicknamed Lake No Negro. What answer do you think you're going to get if you just randomly ask, you know, the entire student body, why don't we talk about those most affected? And I think part of I'm so glad to have you on this conversation with, like, Imagine Black. One of the things you do is you lead with a Black queer feminist lens, which, to basically sum it up for those unfamiliar with the terms, basically like prioritizing the needs of those most vulnerable in the community as a way, you know, with, you know, policy advocacy in a way that it serves everyone. And, you know, you both kind of talked about it a little bit, but can you just talk a little bit more in terms of how you assess how, whether it be PPS or City of Portland, have engaged the community or not engage the community in these public safety discussions?
Such a good question. So it's funny, in a previous life, I used to do quite a lot of public involvement and collaborative kind of design work and teach it at a grad level at PNCA. And I think one big thing that when I hear folks say that they're engaging the community, but they have no data to support who they talk to, it's always a red flag. It's important to actually capture the demographics of the rooms that you're getting feedback on. You would be surprised where folks would say, I had this great conversation. And I was like, well, where is it written down? Is there any, who did you talk to? How do they represent the folks, like Danny mentioned, that are most impacted by the issue? The reality is that we're not all situated the same way. what I love about the Black queer feminist lens is it very clearly states we need to prioritize traditionally silenced and vulnerable populations within the Black community, for example, and very clearly lays out what that looks like. And if it the policy, if the engagement, if the solution doesn't involve those voices, if they didn't get a chance to weigh in, if it doesn't solve issues for them, like, what are we doing? We know, and I think there's been plenty of research and documents and articles and books about how trickle-down things don't work. Like, if we actually really want to create solutions that work, we have to center folks who are most impacted, because their liberation, their freedom, their solutions benefit all of us. So I think a lot about, is this approach data-driven? Are you actually, like I mentioned, are you collecting exit surveys at the end of your engagement, asking folks beyond just, are you Black? But let's ask a little bit more. For example, are you Somali? What's your ethnicity? What's your culture? If folks feel comfortable, what's your gender? What's your sexuality? Are you, what's in terms of how you, your ability, how are you navigating this world? Like, there's so many things that are important. And I think, I believe those differences matter. And if it doesn't work for them, it doesn't work. And it's really frustrating to watch folks replicate systems and pretending like they're doing something when really it's a checkbox. Like, oh, I talked to a Black person, or I talked to a disabled person, recognizing that we're not a monolith. Multiple groups are not a monolith, and you're going to have to extend that reach. So I'm a big fan for data-driven. I'm a big fan that I need to see the numbers to support this idea. If not, I think even a person with the best intentions will have some biases, will kind of center their solutions about what works for them. And reality is it's not where folks are situated.
Yeah, Dan, I know you kind of talked a little bit about it before, but is there anything you'd like to add to that?
I don't know. I think Joy said it best. Give me those receipts.
Oh, yeah, I'm just laughing at receipts and doing weird things. But yes, give us those receipts. What are we doing? 2023, we got the data. Stop playing.
So other part of this conversation, I alluded to it a little bit, talking about just, you know, some of the ads you saw running throughout the midterm elections. And again, it's just funny looking at defund the police radicals and kind of, you know, the fire brimstone stuff, but also, you know, knowing a lot of these people and being like, that you're scared of teachers and social workers, scared of random, like, you know, community servants, that's the enemy. But yeah, you get basically, when you take these positions of even just saying, you know, maybe the police budget is out of control, just maybe we don't need to increase it, you kind of get depicted as this, like, you know, this unserious person who you want the world to burn. You're basically the Joker. But yeah, I know, you know, Joy, at least you kind of talked earlier about how, like, you've kind of evolved on just the way you've looked at policing. And, you know, Dana, I was reading an interview you did with, I believe OPB, was talking about how your mom was actually a survivor of the Thurston shooting. Like, these aren't, you know, we're not talking about, like, abstract, you know, disconnect, or, you know, these abstract concepts, or you being, like, super disconnected. It's very personal things for you both. Yeah, but just to start with Joy, at least, can you just kind of, like, talk about how you've kind of, like, evolved over the years on this? Because I feel like a lot of people think you need to be at the final destination when it comes to these issues.
Yeah, such a good question. You know, I learn, I'm a person who learns through community. Like, I grow through community. I'm held accountable by community, even beyond this role at Imagine Black. You have to learn. And I think as an organization, years prior, you know, we pushed a lot of reforms, and we've seen situations where time and time again, those reforms don't work. Very often we're putting more money into trying to fix something that, if we're honest with ourselves, any other bureau, any other office, industry would have changed. You know, we can't, there's some things that we can't reform our way out of, and that we actually need to hold ourselves accountable to being big, dreaming bigger. I know we're really smart people. We can create a better system that we have currently. Someone dreamt this up. Someone designed this. A group of people designed this. And I think we have way more people power to think and put some of, to noodle on, to think about how to make it better. But yeah, 2020, I think changed us like a lot of folks. We took a look at our community. We listened. We followed organizations that we're in deep community with. You know, we're a member of the Movement for Black Lives, and we joined the coalition at the tail end of 2020. And what we learned is that it doesn't work. I think, and you're right, when people say that, people hear that we're an abolitionist organization or that we're an abolitionist, they assume that's anarchy. They assume that we're so obsessed with burning everything down. When in reality, we're actually really interested in building anew. I think that very often we forget that new things are created every day by a lot of people who are interested in doing different things. But I'm interested in what would it look like if we, like I mentioned before, if when a domestic violence case, we actually have counselors show up. If I have a flat tire, if I've got to get my tags renewed, that someone helps me to do that work. If I'm in mental health crisis, that someone doesn't come with violence. And I think when I have conversations with folks who are in a state of fear and nervous, I ask them if they can tell me a little bit more about after this situation happened, did the police prevent it or did they come afterwards? And the reality is the police come afterwards. They don't always prevent, like media and TV shows and whatever the little crime scene shows will tell you. They don't do that work. They're not all detectives. And the reality is they come after the crime has happened or the harm has happened. And they often bring more violence and harm. So what would it look like if we actually put more money into prevention? What would it look like if we actually are thinking about the holistic care that a person needs? What if we think about housing and healthcare differently and making sure that folks have the tools they need to hold their jobs accountable? What if we actually are not valuing profit over people? What if we're actually looking at capitalism from a very critical lens and realizing and coming to the terms with that that is not it, that we need a transition from this economic system that actually restores and heals folks? And this is someone who, I don't talk to my father often. I really don't talk to them at all, but I'm a daughter of a police officer. I have police officers in my family, and I know they probably thought they were doing the right thing. They probably thought that this, them being there, were going to change the system. And the reality is that's not the case. And we've tried a lot of things. We did our best, but I think it's time that we stop doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I'm thinking about Tyre Nichols in particular. I'm thinking about, I saw a tweet the other day that said that was, you know, there was no guns involved. It was taser. There was multiple police on scene. There was body cams. There were black cops. All these reforms that people talk about is going to be the solution. And it didn't work. It still didn't work. So we have to actually wrestle with the fact that these solutions, these false solutions, are not getting us where we need to go. And it's wild of us to assume that it's going to magically change if we put another million, 2 million, 10 million into a reform that we know just won't work.
And Dan, I wanted to invite you in on one, just in talking about, again, having a mother who kind of survived Thurston, if that, you know, colors how you approach the situation at all. But then I'm just curious if, you know, you've also had any like evolution. Again, it's still a relatively very young person, so there's that context. But just when it comes to the issue of policing and you know, how we, I guess, prioritize that.
Yeah, I think a lot of times, especially when I talk about police abolition, people like to assume that I'm very not connected to gun violence or anyway, you know, the response is, well, you know, when a shooting happens, you know, who are you going to call? Not that police show up and prevent the shootings that already happened, because that's not realistic or what happens in our society. But it also talks to the fact that, you know, survivors of, you know, trauma of gun violence, that trauma also, one, affects the person for their entire life. And two, generational trauma is a very real thing. And so it it is especially sad, you know, every time, like there is a school shooting, in the news, and having to see my mom is just very affected, and especially during, some of the most recent ones, it just really devastates her, and that trauma and that experience is kind of lived through again. And you know, now we live in an age where mass shootings are so common. We're having people who survived not only one mass shooting, but you know, there's a news articles that came out that people are surviving more than one mass shooting in their lifetime, which is absolutely terrible. And so all to say is that this also just goes beyond of how people are affected and how that trauma also trickles into our communities. And that means that we also need to deal with it that way, right? If someone is affected by trauma, we need to have resources, not just for the direct individual, but the direct family members of them as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd be remiss if, and we've talked a lot about specifically this issue with SROs and safety around shootings, but even, you know, when I've had kind of conversations about, you know, why it's important to get SROs out of schools, or how does SROs have a disproportionate effect, or not disproportionate, but disproportionate negative effect on Black and Brown students and students with disabilities in particular, you know, the other thing I also hear is, but what about all the drugs? Someone literally asked me the other day, like, I see Euphoria, I see all this stuff. And one, I graduated in 2007, for anyone watching this, so I'm a decent amount removed from high school, but also still, I don't know, I don't feel like as shocked, just for those out there, by, you know, shows like Euphoria or anything. It's just like, the things change, but it's really kind of the same. But that's another story in itself. But again, to that point about the police arrive afterwards, even then, we've been talking about the new Jim Crow for years. So even when we look at policies like that, what's going to happen if, you know, say, well, there's a drug problem in schools, and we're going to end up disproportionately attacking Black and Brown students with disabilities for that. So that can't be the answer either. But we have another question before we open it up to the audience. So I want to encourage people to, you know, if you want to start throwing questions into the chat, we're going to try and get to as many as possible. Before we do that, though, I just want to ask you both, Joy Lee, Danny, as far as obviously generally like how people can get involved. But I know like one of the big things with these campaigns, it's kind of like that, you know, that really not so glamorous groundwork, but it's very important, whether it be things like testifying, you know, writing officials, calling officials, canvassing. And I know that work can be pretty intimidating for a lot of people. So are there any like words of advice, encouragement you can give to people as far as like just demystifying that process?
Yeah, I would love to start it off. I think folks don't always know how important what we call it as field work, which is like door knocking and phone banking, is to a campaign, whether that it's a candidate campaign or an issue campaign. There's still, despite what people think, there's something still really powerful about that one-to-one conversation. Are able to receive like a pamphlet, they see a candidate knock on their door. That's actually a really, really powerful tool, despite kind of all the technology that we have that folks might think otherwise. I will also say is that it's never been easier to get involved in these things. I think a lot about like my grandparents and that generation and having to door knock and phone bank in a way that just is harder. It's harder when you don't have a list, a technology, you can't push a button and email all your legislators at once. So there's so many different ways that you can get involved and kind of build and escalate those tactics that make you feel more comfortable. So I recommend starting with sending a letter to your legislator. I'm going to put a link in the chat. We have a petition that goes directly to the Portland Public School District's Board of Directors. Start with that. Open up that link, push this button and send a letter and let them know that we don't want police in our schools. Like that's the first step. There's many different ways to get involved with FEALD. I like to say that if you have access to the internet and maybe a headset or some headphones, phone banking online, it seems really daunting. I always have a moment before I start that I'm like, ugh, I have to phone bank. And then when I get on the phone, I get to talk to real people. I get to hear about the things that they are struggling with. I get to hear about their dreams, their aspirations, what they want the future to look like. And I think it's, there's something again about talking to someone on the phone, knocking on their door that just makes this work human and doesn't feel so robotic. So if you can do a phone bank, and the same with the door knock, it's one of those things that I think folks feel uncomfortable. I often bring a friend with me, but I'm also mindful that we need different roles. I'm married to a tall, dark-skinned Black man, and he's very mindful of how he navigates the world and in some ways terrified. He's like, me knocking on a door is different. And so what he does is he goes with me, and he's the person who's at the end of the street, at the sidewalk, looking around, making sure that I'm safe, making sure that our team is safe, and playing a different role and a supportive role in that moment. He's holding the iPad, maybe with the list, and making sure we're holding the thing. So what I'm saying is that there's many different ways to get involved based off your skill set, based off of your ability, the things that you're able to do. And I think they're, we just need it. I'm ranting now, but I'm going to pass it to Danny, a candidate who I know for a fact needs support. I think very often we talk about being outspent in campaigns, thinking about a candidate in particular. And a lot of that, folks who have a lot of money, they can hire a team to door knock for them. They can, do a bunch of media work and pay for a bunch of ads. And okay, we can do that. But again, there's nothing more powerful than talking to someone on the phone. And people power actually gets folks elected, especially folks who are progressive. So I'm going to pass it to Danny. I know you have some things to share.
On this, I would say that like everyone has a skill, 100%. And a lot of people think that they don't. You do. No one doesn't have a skill, right? You can write op-eds, you can write letters to the editor, you can cook, you can feed your community when they're in times of need, you have extra time on hand, you can watch people who need childcare, you can knit clothes for your community. Like I'm saying, like everyone has a skill when it comes to movement building. Everyone has a role to play. You're a lawyer, you have extra time, you can offer law services, right? Everyone has the ability to offer something in this movement for liberation. 100%. 100%. So I'm just going to leave it there. But everyone has a skill and everyone has a role to play.
Awesome. Awesome. So again, everyone, that's DannyForOregon.com. You can go support the campaign, learn more. And again, I just want to thank everyone for being with us tonight. I want to thank Damaris and Vanport Mosaic, Mr. Ford, for hosting us for this conversation, and enjoy the rest of your evening. This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Again, you can catch us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7, or you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. If you want access to exclusive bonus coverage, you can go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. And make sure to follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's numbers with a Z. Or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms or thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z.